My guest today is producer Jonathan Sanger, who has enjoyed over a 40-year successful career as both a movie and theater producer. Now, to date, his films have received 3 Academy Awards, 21 Academy Award nominations, as well as a British Academy Film Award and a French César, among others. Now, Jonathan's film producing credits include, but not limited to, The Elephant Man, Without Limits, Vanilla Sky, and The Producers, The Musical. And he also has numerous director credits of more than 15 episodic TV shows, including Twin Peaks and Wise Guys and L.A. Law. So many of these you recognize, and he is the man behind these shows. And we are here today to discuss the new film Cabrini, the powerful epic story of Mother Cabrini, who sets off on a daring mission to convince the hostile mayor to secure housing and health care for society's most vulnerable. Now, with broken English and poor health, Cabrini uses her entrepreneurial mind to build an empire of hope unlike anything the world had ever seen. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome my esteemed guest today, director, producer Jonathan Sanger, to the show. Welcome.
Good day. How are you? It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's great to talk. It's a great honor to talk to you, and such an incredible resume and career. How did you get into directing and producing films and television shows?
Well, I started out, I started out in theater. I was always interested in theater in high school, and I was the president of the theater club, and I did a lot of directing and acting in those days. I did the same thing in college. I went to University of Pennsylvania, but I gradually decided that I wanted to get more into film, and I went to graduate school in communications with a major in film. So that was really the start of my career. But I also spent a couple of years in South America. I was in the Peace Corps back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I was actually working on a program to make documentary films back in those days.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I think you're probably the third person I've ever talked to that not only served in the Peace Corps, but even some that have served in the military that really ended up being an extension in the areas of film under those departments. I know that George Stevens Jr. was one. I just recently talked to Steve Bender, who had been in the military and being Armed Forces Radio, and started
Taylor
learning
Hackford. Things. Taylor Hackford, another major director, was also, he was in the Peace Corps just a little before me, but I know there are others in Latin America. And, we all started our training in film too, during that period, doing documentary films.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing too, because people like you have actually brought us, history, American history that we'll always remember because it's been captured on film back in the day, which is just amazing to hear, to actually start a film career either Peace Corps or the military. When did you act? What was the first film you ever directed?
Well, I directed a film. I directed a film called, now I'm trying to remember it. I directed a number of documentaries, and I directed a lot of television, but I also directed a feature called Codename Emerald, which was really about the history. And it was a real history about, just prior to the landing of the American troops in France. So it was made in France, and it was an interesting story. I had Ed Harris and another bunch of really interesting actors in it, but it was really about the spy networks that were going on at the time, trying to figure out what the Axis was going to do and finding ways to defeat them. So it was really quite an interesting thing for me. I learned a lot.
So what have you found the differences between, what's more challenging, directing or producing?
Well, I'll tell you, they're very different. I think directing is something that when a director is working, he has to work very close. He or she has to work very closely with the talent, with the actors. And on every day that you're shooting, it's a very narrow focus, but a very deep focus. Whereas supposedly, with a producer, the focus is much, much thinner in a way, but much wider. so that I've got to worry about tomorrow, the next day, the next day. What I'm trying to do is protect my director from having to worry about those things. And the director, I only want to work with the actors and the crew. So it's really a very symbiotic relationship. It's a relationship that I learned having directed and produced. I really enjoyed the idea of working with directors who I could bring something to and help them and protect them and get them to be able to get the best out of their ideas. And that was, you know, I think every time you make a movie, you try to make something, at least I do anyway, where we're all making the same movie so that the you know, if once a director is on the project, as long as we are aligned, and generally we are, then it becomes just, you know, the process of trying to make it happen as well as you can do it. Cabrini is a great example of that, too, as we'll get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, have you ever had projects to where you were both director and producer?
Well, I don't. I actually, yes. I mean, I've done that. But I really think that when you produce and direct, really what you're doing is directing and protecting yourself. So you basically get to name who actually produces. There's nobody who really does both those jobs simultaneously very much. I mean, it's just a way to protect the vision. And so people who want to protect their vision will ask for that credit and basically be able to bring in the people who can support them. I try to do the same thing anyway when I'm working with a director. I want to support the vision of the director and hopefully it's the same. Well, it is. It will be the same vision that I have. So that's how we work, you know, and it's great.
Well, what are the best. Yeah. Well, what are the challenges of producing big budget films like The Elephant Man and Vanilla Sky and even The Producers, for example?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different things that you find that are challenging. I mean, when I did The Elephant Man, even though it was made by released by a major studio, it was made independently. And it was very rare at that time for independent movies to be made. When I say independently, it wasn't owned by a studio. It was owned by a company that I helped set up with Mel Brooks, which was Brooks Films. It was his company. And that was the company that actually owns the movie. And so we had to find a distributor. We had to decide how much money we needed to spend, which was part of it. Was a lot of that was my job in those days. I had to figure out what the budget was going to be and find all the people that we could bring together who could work as a team and make it happen. So it's kind of like building a business from the ground up every time you make a movie. And every movie is slightly different. So it's like a new business every time you go into a new one. You know, and yet a lot of things are the same. So for me, having had a lot of experience, when I come onto a project with a new director and a crew that may not have the same amount of experience I have, I can be very helpful because I've seen things that they may not have seen. And almost everything that can happen on a set, one time or another, I've seen in my career. So at least I can be helpful in trying to solve problems. Which is now, what it is. It's all about solving problems, you know.
Exactly. You know, I watched, it was a film last year that came out called The Offer, which was really the behind the scenes making of The Godfather. So you really get a sense of the director, the producer, and some of the headaches that come along with the job. So
one minor thing about that was that I worked as an assistant director. I was an AD assistant director on Godfather Part Two. So I actually got to see a lot of that up close when I was starting out in New York.
Oh, wow. Now, when you did The Producers, was that the musical for theater or the film?
No, I did the film. I'd actually seen the musical on Broadway. Mel Brooks invited me and we've been friends for 30 years or more now, and actually much more now that I think about it. But he invited me to see the play and I had lunch with him the next day. And I said, look, Mel, if you make a movie of this, I have to produce it. And he said, we'll produce it together. And that was really how it came about. We went out and we pitched it to the major studios and ultimately we were able to do it together. So that was really great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And you actually got to bring the cast over, correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick both came into the film.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, it was great. And they were terrific. It was a wonderful experience. Even the director of the stage play actually directed the movie. So it was her real first opportunity. And she's quite extraordinary. But she's, you know, her career is mainly as a play director, but she came in and did the movie with us. And I spent a lot of time with her kind of orienting her to what movie making was like as opposed to theater, you know. So it was a lot of, I had a lot of opportunity to work together in a good way. So it was great.
Well, is it difficult to take a theater production on Broadway and then turning it into a film and not lose the magic?
It is. I think it is. Yes, it definitely is. And, you know, you kind of need to open it up a little bit to make it a little, you know, I mean, what we did was we filmed in and around New York City in places that could never have been done in a theater setting. And it just gave it a little more space and just a little more pizzazz that we, you know, we added to it in making it. But we also didn't want to ruin anything that had been done in the play. We wanted to keep the sense of the play. And it was very important, for example, to have Matthew and Nathan as part of it, because it, you know, they created those roles on Broadway, and it was really great to have them take them to the big screen. So it is challenging, certainly. Every time you do something like that, where you're transferring something from one medium to another, it's always a trick. You know, it's not easy. You know, it's never an easy thing.
Yeah, and especially with the actors like Nathan and Matthew, they already knew the parts by heart, so it kind of really made the job a little bit easier when transforming it to film.
Well, in that sense, it did. But again, it's, a lot of the technical qualities of working on film are very different. You don't shoot scenes generally in scene order the way they are in a play. And so you're doing things out of order and you're doing things in different ways. And the actors have to accommodate to that notion. But these actors, of course, were comfortable in both mediums, so it wasn't really a problem. But it was interesting because it was different for them too, and they would even say that. I'm sure they would say that it was a totally different experience than doing it on a stage.
Go on. You also did Vanilla Sky, and mm-hmm. you know, Tom Cruise's star has risen to be, I mean, he's literally the mega star of the planet because of Mission Impossible and of these incredible stunts mm-hmm. to where he's doing his own stunts. Mm-hmm. How intense is he on set? Especially with
The best thing, I love Tom because he is a delight for a producer in the sense that he is the first person on the set, the last person to leave. He is completely focused on the work. He won't, when I say he won't tolerate, I don't mean this in a negative way, but he expects other actors to step up and do their work and not fool around. And, you know, I mean, he's great to have on a set because he is completely focused. Yes, he is, you know, it's important to him to get it right. And he cares about it very much. So he is a delight to a producer because you know you're going to get 100% every day, every time. He's always willing to give 100%. And that, you know, you can't ask for more from anybody who's doing that kind of work because it's hard for him too.
Well, yeah, I think it also sets the example for other actors that when they do get other parts in other films, hopefully mm-hmm. they take a little bit of that Tom Cruise work ethic with them and to grow their craft.
I totally agree with you. I think that's the biggest thing I noticed is that other actors are impressed with his devotion to the work and his work ethic. And I do think that it absolutely helps create an atmosphere of a positive atmosphere in terms of a working atmosphere for everybody. So I have nothing but positive things to say about Tom and the way he works. He's a terrific guy.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Tom Cruise. And for you, though, what interested you the most about the story of Mother Cabrini?
Well, this was a case where I had an executive producer who actually was the financier of the movie. And I met him through a friend of mine in New York. This friend of mine said, look, I have this guy. I know this guy wants to make a movie, but he doesn't know anything. He's not a filmmaker. He doesn't know much about movies. You should produce the movie. So I said, well, that's very nice. I'm glad you think that. I said, but let me meet him and let me find out what he's interested in. And we sat down and we had lunch in New York one day. This was back in the beginning of 2018, maybe even a little earlier than that. But it was around 2018. And this is Eustace Wolfington, who is the executive producer and financier of the movie. And he said to me, he says, look, I'm interested in making a movie. That was the first thing he said. And I'm interested in making a movie about Mother Cabrini. Well, I'm from New York and I have heard of Mother Cabrini, but I didn't know that much about her. I mean, I'm from Brooklyn, actually. And there is a school for Mother Cabrini, you know, a school that she had in Brooklyn. So I knew the name and I'd seen her name before, but I didn't know very much about her. And my initial response to Eustace was, so you want to make a movie about a saint, because I knew that she was a saint. I said, you know, I'm not sure I'm the right person to do this. I mean, not that I love the idea, but I think I tend to like to make movies about real people, but people that other people can relate to. And I'm not sure I know how to relate to a saint. This is what I said initially. And he smiled at me and he said, no, you're missing the point. He said, you know, this is really a woman empowerment story. This is a woman. Yes, she happened to be a nun, but she was a woman in a world where men controlled everything. Men did, you know, women didn't do any of the things that she was hoping to do in her life. And she had to defy the church, the city, the archdiocese in New York, all of these things constantly in order to get things done. And she was an incredible entrepreneur. And that was the thing that initially attracted me. And I said, whoa, I understand that. And that's something anybody could relate to. So we started the process of figuring out how to tell the story. Eustace himself was not, he's not a filmmaker. It's not something he wants to do again, I don't think. I think this particular story was something he was interested in out of his own life experience. And he thought that she was someone who never took no for an answer. And in his business dealings, he felt he was very much, you know, he was guided by that principle. So we went on and we tried to develop the story. But I read several books about her. And I realized very early that if we were to do a longitudinal story of her life, it would take 10 episodes at least. I mean, you'd have to do a long-term miniseries. I mean, you know, she did so many things in her incredible life. So I sat down with Rod Barr, who was the writer, and we tried to figure out what to do. And the first early drafts were quite a bit episodic. You know, we were dealing with her in New York, but we were also dealing with her in New Orleans and Nicaragua. She went to other places. And we finally sat down and realized it had to be an origin story. You had to tell the story of her early travels from Italy first to the United States. And the first place she came to was New York. And if you got through that part of the story, everything she did beyond that, and she did many, 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 as you I'm sure know, she did many, many things beyond New York. But she basically set the model for after having done the work in New York, so that everything that happened afterwards was taking that model and perfecting it in other cities and other places, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in New Orleans, in Nicaragua, in Buenos Aires. So the story had to end at the point at which she had her first major successful opportunity to work as a missionary and do good for the poor in New York City. And that became what we decided the story had to be. And we stayed with that. Almost all of it is based on real, everything, in fact, is based on real stories, but not everything happened exactly the way it happens in the movie. For example, there was a fire not in the hospital in New York, but the fire was in a hospital in Chicago. We decided to put it in New York because it helped define the kinds of things that she did in New York. So it worked for the movie without taking away from her extraordinary character. And it was a great opportunity for me to learn a lot about a character I knew very little about. And was to find out that she was the model for Mother Teresa. She was the model for many, many, many people, and not a lot of people knew who she was. So I was fascinated by her life, and fascinated by the opportunity to work with a group of people that really wanted to tell it in a clear way and not make it just a strictly religious movie, but make it a movie that that dealt with the things that drive a human being to become their best selves. That to me was what the movie was about.
And that's what this film is about, because when it was presented to me, it's packaged up like it's a faith-based film. And then when I watched the film, I'm like, this is not a faith-based film. This is a film, a female empowerment story. Mm-hmm. Like you said, a woman that faces so many obstacles, men standing in her way that mm-hmm. at that time, you know, we're talking 1889, sure. that looked down as women as second-class citizens. They're weak. But here is a woman that is so strong, with a deep-rooted belief in her vision, mm-hmm. and the whole sole purpose was not about her; it was about helping those less fortunate. I mean, yeah. and that is a very, just that alone mm-hmm. is a very powerful story. Even when the film ended, mm-hmm. and showing all of the real life photographs and mm-hmm. all of the things that she did. You were right. You only needed to tell the early story, because once she succeeded there, mm-hmm. it just expanded across. Because I even had the same thought. I'm like, this would have been a great streaming series. Yeah. You know, you guys have done 10 seasons.
Future date. But, you know, there definitely are great stories that happened way beyond her New York adventure. But the New York portion of it was really what, It was the thing that molded her and got her to a place where she could teach what she did and train other people to do what she did in other places, where she didn't have to be necessarily, she became the producer and she had other directors, you know what I mean? Once she left New York, but coming to New York, she was directing everything, and that was the way it was. So it was fascinating to do. We had a director who believed in the story from the get-go and understood it in a very strong way. And, even the making of it was done in an unusual way, because it was not, I mean, we were making this movie during the pandemic, right? So everybody had to be tested. You couldn't have any strangers on sets. No one was allowed around that wasn't part of the filming. And even the actors had to wear masks, except when they were actually performing. So it was very, very contained and in that sense. But the other thing about it was that we didn't shoot it in the way, I mean, the fact that we were doing a movie, we weren't doing the typical coverage that you do in a movie where you do over the shoulder, single, single, you know, and then you put it all together later. We were doing very long moving shots, which included close-ups and everything, all in one shot. So it was very theatrical in a way. And you needed actors who could handle that and who could do that, because actors who are trained in theater know that if they're not in the light, they're not going to be seen. So if the light is on and they say, well, I think I would do the scene and I have my face to the back wall. Well, if you have your face to the back wall, no one's going to see you. So you have to find a way to make it work for you to be in the light. And that's what they do. Now, actors like John Lithgow and David Morse are theater trained actors, and they understand that, because we were in a situation where the director would have to say, well, we planned out this complicated shot, but you have to stand over here. It wasn't a situation where an actor could come in and say, well, let me find the scene. No, you couldn't find, if you're going to find it, you're going to have to find it where we tell you to be, because that's the way the scene is going to go. And you had to have actors who were comfortable with that kind of performance opportunity. And as it turned out, we did. I mean, Christiana, for example, was trained in England in the theater, and she really was very comfortable with, as long as she understood the character, she could make anything work within whatever the positioning and blocking was for a particular scene. But as I say, it was unusual. This is not, every movie isn't made that way, as I'm sure you know. I mean, they're all different kinds, but this was a movie that had a flow to it in terms of the work. And interestingly enough, the director had us all look at Citizen Kane before we started shooting, because he wanted to show us a movie that was done in a style that was very different than the typical style most of our crew was used to working in. And I it was completely understandable, because it was very much the way he was working on this particular movie. And, you know, it wasn't something even he had done before in the few movies that he had made. So this was somewhat risky. I mean, for a producer, particularly if I had been working at a major studio, I'll tell you this right now. If I had been working at a major studio, I know that I would have had calls from executives telling me, well, get more coverage. You need more coverage, because we never know if it's going to work. So when you get back, you know, I didn't have that. And I had to really watch every scene and trust that I was getting what I thought I was getting. Thankfully, we did. But, you know, you never know. So it was risky and a little scary while we were doing it. But we were very pleased with the result. And, you know, I've obviously seen it.
It's a beautiful film, because when I was talking to actor Patch Dara.
Oh, sure.
Or Dara. And Dara. It has a very portrait look. The whole film really has this portrait look to it. And the director, Alessandro, I heard that he would do a scene, and then he'd want everybody to come and then rewatch it on the monitor, which for some is unusual to do.
Yeah. No, very, very much so.
You know, so, but I also noticed that in the film, the lighting played a very crucial part in almost in every scene, which is why when you explain, like, the actor needs to stand here, there's a reason for that. Because, and this is one of the few films that I've seen where lighting played a very major role, not just for the look, but also setting the tone of the actual scene.
Well, you know, I will tell you something about that that I think is kind of interesting. The fact that we made this movie during the pandemic kind of brought us an unintended consequence. And that unintended consequence was that our cameraman, who came from Spain, instead of just bringing the cameraman in a couple of weeks before you started shooting, which is normally the way it works on most movies, in this particular instance, we brought the cameraman in for the scouting of the locations, picking the locations. And then we couldn't send him back to Spain, because if he went back, we'd have to go through the whole process of everything that you had to do during the pandemic to get somebody here. So we kept him with us, and he was there for like 6 weeks instead of 2 weeks. So he was able to go to every location with the director and plan out every scene on their own, spend a day, for example, in a location, and figure out what the movement, where the lights, everything that he needed to do that he would not have had the opportunity to do if this was done where he was a last minute arrival. So it gave us the opportunity to create a much more, I mean, it worked for the movie, is what I'm saying. I mean, it worked for the movie in a major way, because we were able to get the absolute best out of everybody we had, because everybody kind of was in it long enough to be able to develop the sense of what the movie was and how to light it and where the light should be coming from. Obviously, there are a lot of shafts of light that you see in this film that come down that, you know, you might see in another religious film, and you might think that's all, but it works for the film because it gives it a warmth and a feeling of, it elevates the scenes in ways that just lighting it flat and straight would never have done. So, you know, we had a lot of these very positive unintended consequences to the fact that we were confined by the pandemic quite a bit. But it was great also for our production designer, because I had worked in Buffalo before, and that's where the film was made. I had done a movie called Marshall a few years earlier, and I realized what a wonderful experience. I had a great experience there. And we were looking for locations, and we were looking in Eastern Europe for Cabrini, and we were looking in Montreal. And I suggested that we take a look in Buffalo, because I knew that there were the doing period up there was possible in a way that you might not be able to do it in New York City. You certainly couldn't get the Five Points area. And the one thing I did know in Buffalo was that when the downfall of industrial Buffalo, which was the steel industry, left, there were all these old brick warehouses, which we turned into the streets that became the streets of Five Points. We used the real buildings and then built stuff on the front of them. You couldn't have done that in New York City or probably very many other places. So it enabled us to have our production designer fell in love with the location because he realized that he could do a tremendous amount of things that he wouldn't be able to do in other cities. So a lot of things converged to make this a very positive experience for all of us, I think.
You know, when you created Five Points, mm-hmm. and I'm looking at the scenes, I was like, wow, because I'm looking at all that had to be done. Mm-hmm. And what a blessing it is to find these old warehouses and then to build the neighborhood mm-hmm. from those buildings, because everything in this film was absolutely authentic. Mm-hmm. And yes. That's what brought so much beauty to this film, from whatever buildings were used as the hospitals, mm-hmm. the abandoned, a very large home by the Hudson. Mm-hmm. Everything just worked. But I noticed that this film took 2.5 years to complete, meaning from the very beginning to finally debuting at the theater. You mentioned the pandemic. Did the strikes have anything to do with it as well?
Well, the strikes happened later and it didn't really affect us. But what we did have a very a long post-production period, longer than you might normally have on a movie. And because we didn't have a distributor when we made the movie, we then had to take it out and take it around to distributors. And that was that's a slow process. We had to go to each one, show them a version of the film, see if they were interested. We had several different distributors that were interested in the film, but it took a fairly long time to get to the place where we wound up with Angel. And Angel came in, you know, was a latecomer to the party in a way, but they were blown away by the movie and they loved it. And we really felt that their care they cared about it enough to stay with it. And we felt that if we just were an independent film that a major studio put out, they might just put it out. And if it didn't do great business the first weekend, that would be the end of it. We felt that these guys would stay with it and work hard to keep it. And we've been very pleased by being able to work with them. It's another thing when you're an independent producer and you work for a major studio, even if you bring them the film, once the film is in finished with post-production, they usually say, goodbye, we'll see you later. And you say, why? And they say, well, we don't need you anymore. We have our marketing people. They know how to sell the movie. And my contention has always been, I said, yes, I am sure you do have the right people. I said, but wouldn't it be a good idea to at least have one of us who was with the project stay with it? Even if I'm not saying you have to take our opinion, but we've been with the project for 5 years and you've been with it for 2 hours. You know, I mean, why don't you? You might want to hear what we have to say because we might have an idea that might be useful. And generally, they don't. I mean, that's not what they do. Well, when I became an independent, I did it mainly because I wanted to be involved in the process all the way to the theaters. And it was the only way that you could possibly do that. And with Angel, it actually occurred because we have meetings with them twice a week. We have one tomorrow morning. We had one yesterday. We meet with them in the morning on Zoom. We talk about different strategies for everything that we do. And it absolutely works. One of the things, by the way, that came up out of these meetings was the song with Andrea Bocelli and his daughter that's in the end credits. We thought about that years ago. I mean, literally, when we finished the movie, but it wasn't even possible. I mean, Bocelli was on tour and we didn't know if we could get him and whether we could afford him or any of those things. When Angel came in and we talked about maybe having a song in the end credits of the movie, we mentioned to them, we said, well, we do have a song, and we did have we thought about it, but we just couldn't do it. And they really said, no, you don't realize this is really important. You should do this, but let's find a way. And they helped us find a way to get Bocelli back into the fold and have him sing this song with his daughter. And we wound up putting it in the end credits. And that only happened in the last month, or maybe the month before we released the movie. So it shows how things were happening all the way till the very end, until the movie was released.
Well, what I love with the fact that this film was released in the theaters,
yes,
was that Hollywood needs to wake up. Everybody is sick of DC and Marvel. Mm-hmm. Everybody's sick of, you know, what I would call poor quality action films, because they think that's the only thing you can do to drive people to the theaters. Look, I love the next Mission Impossible as much as anybody else. And but we need more films that are period pieces. I mean, Poor Things, I guess you would call it, as a period piece. And it ended up, you know, being nominated for multiple Academy Awards. Cabrini is that type of quality. At least it is to me. And this is a film like, I know so many people in the faith-based world. They said, "Have you seen Cabrini yet?" And I said, "Yes, but it's not a faith-based film. It is female empowerment, because she's a nun." Okay, and to me, every little girl, every teenage girl, every young woman, mature woman, needs to see this film, because it's a template to show them all things are possible. And that's the thing about this film. This film is not preachy one iota.
And well, Dr. Blunt, I completely agree with you. I do. And I think you actually got the most out of the film that any of us could have hoped for, because you got exactly what our intention was. We don't expect the film is going to turn off a faith-based audience. They're still going to be there. They should see it, because it's about a character in their history that they should know about, and it's important. But it doesn't, you know, instead of indicating, and I am all for prayer, please understand me when I say this, I'm not talking about anything that is negative in the faith area, because I am, you know, I believe in faith, and everyone who was connected to this movie did too. But it's the sense that you can't wait for it's not just a sign from heaven. It's, you have to find it within yourself. Maybe it may come from God, it may come from Christ, it may come from your belief system, but you have to act on your own, and you have to go and make things happen. And that's what we felt about this movie. It wasn't a woman who was waiting for the word to come to her that made her do something. She empowered herself. She let things happen, and she was empowered certainly by her religious beliefs, no question, but she made things happen. She did not sit on her hands and wait for something, a miracle to occur to her. She went out and created the thing that became the miracle. And that, well, to me, was why I loved it.
That's why the message of Cabrini is so powerful. Because again, when I watch the film, I'm like, this is not faith-based. This is not just female empowerment. But the film literally put, it depends on how somebody watches the film. It can put the Bible in the motion, because if anybody knows what the word says, Cabrini lived exactly what the word says. God says he blesses hard work. She put in the hard work.
Yes.
You know, she walked by faith, not by sight. Yeah, she had the vision of, she knew what could be done and created. You do have to have that. It's kind of like you have to have a vision on how you want your film to be and what to look like when it's finished. But there's a lot of steps of faith to go through. As you know, as a producer, you know, some days you're like, good Lord, are we ever going to, we're going to get this thing financed or what? Or is so-and-so actor finally going to say yes? So, you know, there's a lot of steps to take. But Cabrini, the film itself and the basis of this story, brings everything to life. I mean, we could go in the book of James and say, you know, faith without works is dead. Well, guess what? Cabrini put her faith to work. It's the action. Mm-hmm. See, like you said, miracles, yes. Miracles happen only because man can't do anything to make it happen. Only God can. That's what makes it a miracle. Mm-hmm. And that's why she became a saint. Yes. And Jonathan, this is a film that I hope that continues to resonate years to come, because this is a film that's a testimony not just to women, but for even men. Because even when I watched, I was like, oh yeah, I'm writing that down. I mean, I'm writing down all of these amazing lines and these quotes in which came out of her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And because you can literally just repeat them to yourself going, okay, because that drives it. This film is an inspiration. It's a motivation. It should get people moving, and hopefully it gets certain people moving, just like it did Cabrini, to help those that are less fortunate.
That's our greatest hope. You know, I mean, movies are entertainment, but it's also nice when a movie has something that you can take away from it after you've seen it, and it makes you think and it makes you act. And I hope that this is a movie that actually empowers people to do the kinds of things that Mother Cabrini influenced. And I believe in that. I really do personally. And I think I believe in it in terms of how I approach an audience. I want that for an audience, you know. So it's great that we can have it.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jonathan, as I was watching the film, there is, you know, there's multiple scenes that are very, I say, like-minded. They mirror one another. So I love the fact that she went over the Eminence's head and made the Pope tell her, got the Pope's blessing. Then she had to go over the Archbishop's head. She went basically over that doofus in the movie who kept standing in her way, said, oh, you're never going to see the mayor. Yeah, so she ended up seeing the mayor. So she always, to me, it mirrored the exact story in the New Testament where the woman was always bugging the judge. And when she bugged the judge to the point to where the judge's like, fine, you can have whatever you're wanting. Just get out of here. I'm tired of you coming to me and bugging me. And in a way, she did it, but she did it with such tenacity. And this is one of my, so far, this is one of my favorite films of the year. And,
I want to say one thing before you ask. One thing that you mentioned was that every young girl and their mothers and everything should see it. I think it's very important for men to see it, because I think men will learn a lot about, and it will break some of their prejudices against, what women can and cannot do, which is something that comes very early when the Pope says, you know, by giving you this ability to go to the States and do this, it will show what a woman can or cannot do. And she took that challenge and said, well, it's going to be what a woman can do. Showing that, I think, is incredibly important to men as well as women. So I really think men should see it. Even if they're brought by their wives or their girlfriends or their friends, you know,
I mean, I agree. Cause I love the movie. I loved her strength. It was an inspiration and a motivation to me. One of the best quotes, in the movie is when she says, you know, begin the mission and the means will come. For you, does this quote work when stepping out to produce a film?
I can't tell you, there is no quote I can think of in this movie that is more connected to what a producer has to do, at least an independent producer like me, because I have to start the process and I have to get people to believe in me. And ultimately, I have to find the means, and the means is that's the hardest part always. But I've been able to do it a few times, and I hope I'll continue to be able to do it. So I'm excited by that. Even in this case, finding the means was always tricky and hard, but you had to get started. If you just talked about it, you're never going to get it done. You have to actually get out in the field and get your hands dirty and figure out a way, do the work, and the means will come. And I think it has, you know, and in many, many, many cases for me, it has. So I'm very excited about that notion.
Well, how important is the independent filmmaker to the lifeblood of the film industry right now?
I think the independent filmmaker is critical. And I think exactly what you said, if you could have imagined a movie like this during the, you know, when we were in the pandemic and there was no theatrical distribution, I could never have, and we were making this movie, we all assumed we were going to wind up with a movie that's only going to be played on television sets or, you know, it's going to be streamed, but it'll never have a theatrical distribution. And it's, as you said, the only things that seem to be getting theatrical distribution historically, other than the rare occasions where you have something, are movies that are sequelized, that are they're comic books, they're superheroes, and those are the one, you know, and action movies of one kind or another, but usually action movies that can be sequelized so that there'll be another one afterward. To take a story that really doesn't necessarily have a sequel and get it into, you know, 2,500, 3,000 theaters is a remarkable fact and something that we never would have imagined. You know, we look at that and we say, well, this must have been Cabrini looking down on us because this is not something we anticipated or expected. But I do believe, as you say, people are getting tired of seeing the same old Marvel, Histar, you know, those kinds of projects, and that a really well-made, good movie that it has an experience that you can relate to and take something from is definitely something that can play theatrically. And my hope is that distributors begin to understand that and realize, wait a minute, we can actually make money with a movie that isn't a sequel and that isn't, isn't a comic book. So, I mean, I don't think it's going to be easy. I don't think a lot of movies will hit the bar, but the ones that do and can should be released theatrically. I don't knock the notion of them ultimately playing on streaming and other, because you want them to get to as wide an audience as possible. But there is an experience in a movie that has this kind of visual scope that is really wonderful to see in a dark room, you know, with other people and seeing it that way. And I'm so pleased that we had the opportunity to do that. And, you know, that people are seeing it in theaters that I love. You know,
well, is streaming killing the theater experience?
I don't know that it's killing it, but I think what happened during the pandemic, and I'm was a victim of it, is that I watched everything that I'd never seen. All I did was stream. I mean, that was it. During that period of time, I didn't go out. I couldn't go to the stores. I couldn't, you know, my wife and I sat home and we watched shows that we had never seen. And the unfortunate thing is that the large bulk of the stuff that is on Netflix is stuff that I'll never watch. I don't care about. And that the great stuff is usually the small percentage. I can't knock streaming because it pays the bills. You know, I couldn't be making films if there weren't an opportunity to get them into streaming opportunities. But you also want to have a way to figure out how to keep the theatrical experience alive. And I think independent filmmakers are all thinking about that these days. They've been disappointed over the last couple of years, thinking that they're not going to be able to do it. And every opportunity, every movie that comes along that breaks that notion is a positive sign. And I hope this is a positive sign for getting theaters to be, you know, want to show movies that are not the same old that you talked about.
Yeah, I noticed that with Cabrini, especially on the marketing side, some of the marketing was kind of piggybacked in a way by the wording of combining it with Sound of Freedom, because Sound of Freedom was a freak of nature at the theater.
No question. Yeah.
You know, $200 million at the box office.
I'll tell you, I saw the movie and I'm obviously a big fan of Alejandro's, and I saw the movie before it was any place and I liked it, but I thought, nobody's going to release this film. That was my first, my experience was, it's going to be very hard to get this movie released. And then it was shelled by Disney. And it, you know, it was just one of those, as you say, it's a freak of nature. It's not a model for which other people can say, oh, that's the way you do it, because you can't make that happen again that way. But that was that movie. And in fact, it, we had signed a deal with Angel before, before that movie came out, before Sound of Freedom came out. So we didn't, we, I mean, we weren't just I mean, we ultimately, of course, you're going to piggyback on the success of any company. And that was a big success. And it also had the same director. So there is value in that. But, you know, it wasn't, you know, that wasn't planned. No one could have imagined that something like that might happen.
Well, does the theater distribution model need to change?
I definitely think it does. I do. I do think it does. I think the theater model, the advertising model, all of those models are, nobody really knows what actually drives people to see movies. I mean, yes, they do know there's certain things that are pretty obvious, you know, big star names and you know, which will get people to go see something. And then if they don't like it, they'll be disappointed, but it'll still make its first weekend, you know, those kinds of projects. Then there are, you know, the action projects, which are going to get a certain audience that will come see them. Again, they're not going to last, but I do think that that the major studios certainly have to take a hard look at what they've been doing recently and figure out some new plan, you know, and I don't have the answer, but I think I want to be part of the people, the group that asks the question. I want to be in the, again, I want to be in the room so I can help that happen, because the kinds of movies that I want to make, and it's true, I will tell you this. I mean, at this stage, I've been making movies a long time. And I, in the early part of my career, I would have made movies about anything that anybody, if somebody brought me a movie and said, would you produce it? I probably would have said yes. Now I won't say yes, because if I go to see, if I go to a movie and I come out of the movie and want to kill myself, that's not a movie I'm going to make. I may go see that movie, but I'm not going to make that movie. If a movie has no hope in its message in any way, I don't think I want to make it now. I mean, I we live in a world that is, that has a lot, you know, there's a lot of hopelessness out there, and I don't want to contribute to that. I want to bring in words and deeds and movies that can do something to make people, you know, alleviate their pain and make them feel that there's an opportunity and there is hope, because I believe in hope. I do.
Well, so yeah, but
I want that in movies, you know.
And I agree with you, because this past Oscar season, mm-hmm, I probably watched and interviewed 60 film directors,
I'm sure,
of short films that were qualified, shortlisted, and of course the ones that were nominated.
Mm-hmm.
These films were dark.
Mm-hmm.
If you told me to, I could only pick two films, neither one got nominated, which was a shame because they deserve not only to be nominated, they deserve to win, that brought hope. Everything else was dark. Mm-hmm. It was, I don't want to say depressing, because I get the storylines, but I'm like, are people that depressed that they're only focusing on, you know, grief, death, and things of that sort? And I'm like you, I saw two films that I can even remember out of the whole bunch that were positive, brought a smile to your face. When it was over, you're like, oh man, I'd love to see a full feature of that film, because it gave you a great warm feeling. But we need more of that. Cabrini is one of those films, because you walk through the fire with her, but she didn't get burned.
No, that's exactly right. No. I mean, getting involved in it, all of those things came together in making it. And they were all things that were very, they were things that I thought about. I mean, I was very clear on my own reason to be involved in a project like this. It meant a lot to me. And, you know, the projects that I'm hoping to make in the future are also projects that I think, I mean, as you say, it isn't that there won't be moments of depression and in terms of character and stuff like that. That's going to happen. But it's hard for me to want to get involved in something that is hopeless, you know, that there's nothing that you get that you can take from it. I mean, I have a project which I'm hoping to make maybe next year, and it's about the Wright brothers, and no one's ever made this story, and I didn't know it, but it's a strange story because it was when the Wright brothers were trying to build a plane that would be a heavier than air vehicle that could get up in the air. At the same time, Samuel Langley, who Langley Air Force Base was named after, was also doing that, and he was supported by the government. And they spent maybe what would have been millions of dollars in those days, back in the 1902 or 3, and he built a plane. Langley did. And there was a big parade for him in Washington, D.C. He took off and the plane crashed immediately in the Potomac. And he came out that day and he said it will take man probably another 50 to 100 years before anyone's capable of making a heavier than their vehicle fly. 5 days later, the Wright brothers took off at Kitty Hawk. And this is the story. I mean, it's mostly about them, but it's the story of this. Having an idea and then taking off, you know, and that there's no way that can't be a hopeful, you know, a hopeful movie when you see it. So it's a movie.
I want to see this movie.
Okay. Well, I'll let you know how it's going when I can get it done.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of a film that it's a type of film that I wish Hollywood would really bring back. And Robert Redford did a film called The Great Waldo Pepper.
Right, right, right.
Those are the films I miss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that was a great one. I do remember that. Yep.
You know, we need just those kind of films again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love old Hollywood. I want to see some of that brought back into modern day. But I 110% agree with you, Jonathan. We need to have more films that project hope. So when you leave the theater, you can't wait to get back to the theater again.
I completely agree. I definitely do. You know, it's definitely what I want. And I hope that I'm able to contribute to it. The truth of it is, someone said to me not too long ago after seeing Cabrini, they said, oh, there was something very old fashioned about it. It reminded me of when I loved movies and I went to see a movie just for the movie. And the fact that someone told me it was old fashioned did not upset me at all. I said, yeah, well, I mean, that was intended, you know, it's meant to be an experience that you can take with you just the way you used to. So yeah, in that respect, I completely agree.
Well, kudos, and much success and blessings to the whole crew that brought Cabrini to life. I mean, many thanks to Alessandro Monteverdi for directing such an incredible film. He has a very big, bright future ahead of him.
Yeah, he does.
And as well as you have the resume that most people may never have in Hollywood, but you brought this incredible film. And ladies and gentlemen, the film Cabrini is an inspiration and a strong motivator to all of us. I mean, the quotes in the film will inspire and motivate you that you too can make your vision happen. I mean, look, for example, Mother Cabrini says twice in the film, begin the mission and the means will come. How many of you can dare to do that? I mean, this is a statement of unwavering faith. She had tuberculosis when she was younger and was only given at least maybe 5 years to live. But because of her, well, boldness, stubbornness, and tenacity, she lived to be 67. And even her next statement in the film is something that for all of us to adhere to. We can serve our weakness or we can serve our purpose. And Mother Cabrini leaves us with a statement that leaves, well, all of us with the dare to dream and do big things. The world is too small for what I intend to do. Do you have what it takes to make a statement like that? Of course you do. Especially when your focus is to help others. Even the Pope told Mother Cabrini, I can't tell where your faith ends and your ambition begins. But once you see the film Cabrini, you may feel that you can conquer the world and do something good in it as well. And Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for an enlightening and wonderful conversation about this film and a little bit of your work.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. It was great. Great to talk to you.
Hey, thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for watching and listening. And as for me, I'll either see you at the, see you at the movies or from the red carpet. And remember, connect with us at Bond on Cinema.